Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind, the show where we replay or re-air some of our favorite segments and interviews we did in the past because some things deserve a listen to more than once. I'm your host, Kyle Filson, and on today's show, we're going all the way back to May 5th, 2014, when we did an exclusive interview with the legendary John Anthony West. This, perhaps, is one of our favorite interviews we've ever done. John Anthony West was an American author, lecturer, guide, and proponent of the Sphinx water erosion hypothesis. Influenced by the works of R.A. Schwaller de Lubitz, in 1993, his work with Robert Schock, also a geologist and associate professor at the University of Boston, was presented by Charlton Heston in an NBC special called The Mystery of the Sphinx. This won a news documentary Emmy Award for Best Research and nomination for Best Documentary. I remember seeing that as a little boy. I had no idea that one day in the future I'd actually get to speak to the guy. This documentary, in case you haven't seen it, contends that the main type of weathering evident on the Great Sphinx itself and the surrounding enclosure walls could only have been caused by prolonged, extensive rainfall during the time period from 10,000 to 5,000 BCE and was carved out of limestone bedrock by an ancient advanced culture. Now, this view, of course, challenges the conventional dating of the carving of the Sphinx, which they say is about 2,500 BCE. West suggests that the Sphinx may be over twice as old as originally determined, whereas Schock made a more conservative determination between 5,000 and 7,000 BCE. I happen to believe John Anthony West. I think he's absolutely right. When you look at the Sphinx and you see the weathering, it looks like it's been eroded by water. And we know by looking at the dates, the last time there was a lot of rainfall in that part of the world was long, long before 2500 BCE. So without wasting any more of your time, let's get into the interview. I hope you enjoy John Anthony West. All right, folks, we have got a hell of a treat. This fellow that we are fixing to speak with right now is the one that really kind of got the ball rolling for me and Kyle years and years ago and blew our hair back with some of the amazing information that he brought forth. And it is a true honor to get to speak to this fellow. This is Mr. John Anthony West. Mr. West, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Kyle and Cam.
It's
great. I mean, it really
That's
is
a real
great.
Honor.
It is. We've kept up with your work, like we've said off air. Whenever we were young men, we first saw the documentary with Charlton Heston, and you were talking about the water erosion on the Sphinx. And back then, it was really a new idea. It was something really that nobody could wrap their heads around. And it seems like now there are dozens of little things that add vindication to all of your theories that what you and Dr. Schock came up with.
Yes, actually. Some of them are not little things either. Major things. And it's interesting if you, I mean, obviously you've been following it from the very beginning. So in the beginning, I should say actually right from the get-go that the water weathering to the Sphinx was not my idea. It was, or not my original idea. It came from the genius with the unpronounceable name, R.A. Schwaller de Lubitz, who put together in a number of, I mean, I regard Schwaller as probably the most important scholar, not just of the 20th century, but maybe of all time, who put together and reformulated the ancient sacred science in a way that made it accessible to our modern over-rationalized intellects. And in one of his books, his masterwork is called Le Temple de l'Homme, The Temple of Man, which when I did my book on him, had not been translated from French, but now it is in a wonderful translation, great book. But it's like taking your first driving lesson in a Ferrari if you're not used to this sort of thing. Anyway, it was Schwaller who was looking into the Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian belief, maybe they knew, that anyway, their records talk about long periods of civilization pre-dynastic Egypt. Dynastic Egypt, that's the Egypt we're all familiar with, starts around 3500 BC. And in these several documents, One is a stone tablet. The other one is a fragmentary a papyrus. The stone tablet called the Palermo stone because it's in Palermo in Italy. Second called the Turin papyrus, not because it's about Turin, but because it's in the Turin Museum, where they detail explicitly, they talk about long reigns when Egypt was ruled first by what they call by the Netcheru, which means the gods themselves. And secondly, when it's, again, a long period when they're ruled by the Shemsuhor, which means the companions or the followers of Horus. And they give the names of these rulers and their regnal years. And when you compute all of those out, you actually get something around. They're a little bit, they're both fragmentary, the stone, the tablet and the papyrus, but they're talking about something like 36,000 years. Anyway, De Lubitsch, in one of his ancillary books called The King of the Pharaonic Theocracy, all of this De Lubitsch stuff, actually, which was not translated when I was doing this work back in the early 70s, is now all translated and very well, too, so anybody can read it. Anyway, he's talking about the Egyptian belief that their own civilization went back much, much further. And at a certain point, he brings together the scholarly arguments and the quotes from the Latin and Greek writers who were working in Egypt around that time. And then, almost as an afterthought, throws out this line. And of course, the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of aquatic erosion, water weathering. And when I read that, I was doing my own research for my first book on Egypt called Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, which is an in-depth introduction to Schwaller. As I said, raw, unadulterated Schwaller is not for everyone. It's very difficult stuff. But I sort of provide a bridge to his magisterial work. Anyhow, when I read that line, I said, oh, well, that's all the rest of it is a scholarly argument, but water weathering is water weathering, and that, in theory, is science. If you can prove it, and I got this in an instant, it was one of those revelations, that if you could prove that the Great Sphinx of Giza had been water weathered, it would basically destroy everything that anyone has ever been taught in school about ancient history, or very ancient history, because it would mean that, and mind you, at this time when I came across this, I'd already put several years of research into Serpent in the Sky. But I realized that if you could prove that, the Sphinx is arguably, or almost incontestably, the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, even though it's in ruinous condition. And the temples that surround it they're not that huge as Egyptian temples go, but they're constructed of stones that weigh, you know, upwards of 100 tons each, slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle or like giant building blocks. And, of course, the flower of our present civilization, which I call is not really a civilization, it's progress is the antithesis of civilization. I call it the Church of Progress. Its central dogma is that we're the most advanced beings that have ever existed on the face of the planet. We who create the hydrogen bomb and nerve gas and Disneyland and striped toothpaste, we're the best there ever was. And the people who created the Temple of Luxor and the pyramids and all of these other things in Egypt and the cathedrals of Chartres, all of these were primitive, superstitious people. Anyhow, the point is that technology and science are the pride of the civilization. And if you could prove that the Sphinx dated many, many thousands of years older even than dynastic Egypt, and the Sphinx is, as I said, is not too many people would argue that this is the most spectacular sculpture on Earth. And when you do a bit of research into the temples that surround it, you find that modern project engineers, you know, the guys who work with the cranes that can lift 1,000 tons and things like that, when they see the problems involved in building one of these temples of 100-ton blocks and things of that sort that are slotted into place, as I said, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, they say, well, we couldn't do that with our machinery. So if you could prove that the Sphinx is weathered by water, it would mean that a civilization capable of producing one of the greatest or the greatest sculpture of all time. And these temples that we couldn't reproduce today with our advanced technology existed at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization at all. Everything has to be rethought. Right from the get-go, everything has to be rethought. So you can see why we've encountered the opposition that we have. This is no surprising. You have to realize that academics, or who I like to call quackademics, this is a, you know, there's no glamour to being a quackademic, not much anyway, and there's not much money either. These guys have their PhDs that they work very hard for, and their egos, you might say their souls insofar as they have them, their egos are completely bound up in their status as experts. And then along suddenly comes a guy like me from out of left field with no credentials whatsoever and says, well, here's the scientific proof, scholarly proof, that you're completely wrong. Everything you've been talking about for all of these years is baloney. Well, they're not going to like you very much.
No,
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, you weren't making friends very fast like that.
No, but that's okay. I enjoy that, actually. I mean, most of my colleagues, many of them, would... Well, see, I didn't start out as a scholar. I started out as a novelist, playwright, scriptwriter. And, I mean, I knew just a little bit of autobiography, a couple of lines, that at the age of 13, I knew that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum. I knew that it was crazy and that everybody was lying, including myself. And by the time I was 19, I knew what I wanted to do, which was to be a writer. And I wanted to be the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. And that's what I started off doing. And one thing led to another. It's a complicated, kind of interesting, long story. But when I finally got into Egypt, I realized that there was an alternative and that the Church of Progress really was a catastrophe. I mean, I sometimes describe it as the Western civilization as the worst catastrophe that hit the human race since monogamy. this is an absolutely pernicious philosophy, and it is false. It is not science. It is not science-based. So suddenly, when I got into Egypt, I realized it was a chance to really upset a lot of people, to really make waves. And so, basically, that's what I've been doing. But to get back to the point you were making, when we did that, really, that was groundbreaking, because there was other evidence out there, but nothing with the kind of backup that you could provide for the Sphinx. Once I got Shock on board, that's another long story. But when finally Shock got on board, and Shock's a very cautious guy, when he finally realized that the evidence was incontrovertible, he stuck his tenured neck on, you know, put it on the block, supported it. That led to the GSA, the Geological Society of America's annual meeting, which is kind of the Super Bowl of geology, back in 91, and then that, through a series of very strange circumstances, the whole story. Shock and I are going to write a book very shortly. We're going to be working on a book about the whole Sphinx story. And now that we've got the smoking gun with Göbekli Tepe and maybe Gunung Padang, there's a whole bunch of stuff out there. But anyhow, so we'll be doing a book about it. But at that time, all we really needed to have, in theory, if scientists were actually open-minded, which they're not. I mean, when I give lectures, I often come out with a line which always gets a laugh, that finding an open-minded scientist is like finding a fundamentalist Christian who loves his enemies. A few and far between. So anyway, when... You know, the fact that the evidence was the evidence and that the geologists were almost 100% in agreement made waves, but they kept on saying, you've seen the video, probably saw the whole thing with the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, supposed debate with Mark Lehner saying, show me a pot chart. Well, I used to joke and say, you know, well, it was a really advanced civilization. They didn't have pot chart, they had paper cups. But, of course,
it was all biodegradable. They took care of the planet.
Absolutely biodegradable. But anyway, so now we still don't have any pot charts, but we have a whole gigantic elegantly constructed civilization going with Göbekli Tepe, which is a mind blower. And I mean, even the quackademics are not arguing about the dating. They're accepting it, but they're not doing it exactly. Because this was, Göbekli Tepe was the lead, it was the cover of National Geographic, May 2012 or 2011. Anyway, it was, I know it was a May issue. And so they go into it in considerable detail, but what they don't say, they kind of avoid saying, hey, this is a game changer. This turns the whole thing around. No longer can you talk about primitive hunter-gatherers, you know, before they invent or before they develop agriculture, 7,000-8,000 BC, thereabouts, before the great civilizations of Mesopotamia and Egypt and China and India and probably Mesoamerica as well, arise 3,500, 3,000 BC. It was all just, you know, hunter-gatherers doing simple things and whittling, you know, carving out arrowheads and that sort of stuff. Suddenly you have Göbekli Tepe, this unbelievable place of, I mean, the whole story is very complicated and I won't get into it here, but 22 closely adjacent mini Stonehenges, and not that many, I mean, blocks of stone weighing 10, 15 tons each and intricately carved in high relief, which is the most difficult kind of carving to do, because it means that, let's say you want to carve an animal. So you draw the animal on the surface of the stone, and then you cut the stone away so that the animal or the bird or the bee or whatever it happens to be looks as though it's emerging out of the stone rather than being cut into the stone. They're doing this at a time when apparently they don't have any tools. I mean, really, this is spectacular because it's assumed that they did this somehow or another with flint tools. And, I mean, there is no, you know, you don't have a Dremel tool to work with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it just reconfirms your original thoughts.
See, and so when you really look at Göbekli Tepe, this is unbelievable. I mean, this is spectacular. And that's us. I mean, that's one of our smoking guns. So now, having fought this battle for all of these years, and this is what our book is going to be about, is the whole battle, because, I mean, we've been flak coming at us and the abuse and all of this kind of stuff. And, I mean, Shock, you know, Shock is not a satirist by trade, so initially, you know, he didn't really know how to react to all of this abuse. I expected it. And to me, when these guys attack, I mean, I feel the way a cannibal chieftain must feel watching a boatload of missionaries approach.
Right.
I couldn't be happier, particularly now when you've got the internet. Before, it used to be irritating because they'd attack publicly and there was no way for me to attack back publicly because they wouldn't print it.
Yeah, and for our listeners that may not know, in the early 90s, there was a movie that came out called Mysteries of the Sphinx, and that's what John's referring to. Is he was one of the first guys to discover that, and I wasn't aware. When I first saw it, I didn't know that the age of the Sphinx was even contested until I saw that movie, and I became very interested and I always thought it was just known, you know, when they teach you in school, you're like, okay, it was made 2500 BC. It was made after Khafre. It's his face. And then it turns out, you know, after I saw your show, I started looking into it. And that's not exactly so. There's people that don't even think it's Khafre's face, that they think that it could be a different race's face on there, maybe a lion's head originally. And based on some of the stuff I've read, the way the structures are set out, that by the precession of the equinoxes, that it's far older than what I was taught.
Well, and their even history in the Egyptian history themselves, they say themselves that they're a much older culture, yet the Egyptologists today don't even want to read their own, that history.
No, they know more about Egyptian history than the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah, makes no sense.
And so the battle you guys are referring to is when you first brought this data out, you know, it was highly contested, but now these other structures that are being found, you're being vindicated, you know, almost, you know.
Well, we are, but it's still highly contested. Because it's still their battlefield. In other words, it's we're fighting it out on their battlefield. So what happens when you're fighting on their arena, when you know, when they don't like the evidence, they change the rules. And when when they can't do that because you still overthrow the rules, then they move the goalposts.
It's like playing cards with a child.
You know, or they try to discredit you because you don't have a degree or certain
letters after your name.
Right, that's
no, no, no. Well, that's, they can do that with me.
But it's ridiculous. That's, you know, that's not science.
Yeah, they can't with Robert.
They can't with Chuck. No, actually, that's a funny story about that. When this thing first came out, it was when 93, the, no, it was the 91, the GSA meeting. And Chuck came out in favor. And it was a big deal, this. I mean, it made the science press all over the world. It was a big story. And lots, you know, press was there. And we were doing interviews all over the place, Chuck and myself. And Chuck was, he teaches at Boston University. And we had a radio, telephone interview with a guy who was the science editor of the Boston Globe, which is the big paper there. And so Chuck was being his usual civil self in the interview. And then the guy interviewed me and he said, well, you know, what is this? You're the geologist and, you know, you have these people, you know, really going after us big time. I mean, insulting us as character assassinate, all this kind of stuff. And he said, what's behind that? And I said, look, you know, this is a question of water weathering patterns or weathering patterns on rocks. And when it comes to weathering patterns on rocks, an Egyptologist and the opinion of an Egyptologist or an archaeologist is no more valid than the opinion of a proctologist.
You're 100% right, though. I mean,
and he published that. So,
that is great.
So then,
you're a real smartass, aren't you, John?
John puts it to him, don't he?
I like it.
I am a satirist.
He's honest.
Capitalist by trade. I'm a scholar by default. So what I bring to this whole thing is, I mean, you know, I do a comedy act. I can be funny about stuff that people are not usually funny about. So I'm really dangerous.
Yeah, but you're 100% right. I mean, just because they're an Egyptologist doesn't mean they have anything about geology.
They don't know anything about rocks.
So anyway, this woman whose name I will not mention because she'll probably sue me, at Boston University, archaeologist, I think, or Egyptologist, or both, wrote a really nasty character assassination of Shock on the in-house Boston University journal or newspaper, whatever the devil it's called. And I said to Shock, you know, Shock, you can't let them get away with this. You've got to respond. Shock said, no, just let it go. I'll handle it my way. And I said, well, do you mind if I write her personally?
Uh-oh.
He said, no, go ahead. That's okay. So I wrote her one letter. And I said, I started out by saying, listen, I understand that you and your department take this line of mine about the, you know, proctologists and the Egyptologists, you know, that got you very upset. And I said, well, you should know that it got the proctologists upset too, because they said their job was to cure sick assholes. So what she did, it was like Br'er Rabbit, and the Briar Patch. She went and she sent this out to the whole Egyptological community. I mean, I couldn't have done that myself.
Yeah, worked perfect.
We could have done. But anyway, so this thing has been going on now. That's 20 years. You know, that's 93 that the documentary came out.
Yeah.
Don't remind me, John. My knee feels it every morning when I get up.
Well, yours feels it. How old are you?
38.
Oh, God. I'm more than double your age.
It's not the years. It's the mileage.
Well, the mileage. Yeah. Anyway, so we're now, Chuck and I are going to write the book. We're setting up a foundation. I had a foundation for myself, but I kept the book so badly that the lawyer said, oh, forget it, just start a new one. So we're doing that to try and get both money together to carry on with the research, which is a big deal, and then more money together to do a follow-up video of Mystery of the Sphinx. So this is the position that we're now in. We, between Göbekli Tepe and now Gunung Padang, Shaka has just been there. And Shaka's a really cautious guy, you know. I mean, he couldn't have a better colleague than Shaka, because he's, I mean, one, he really is smart. He really knows the science. And he's got the credentials, and he's very, very, very cautious. I mean, super cautious, so that he really only, I mean, he has to be 100% convinced that the evidence is the evidence and cannot be overthrown. So, I mean, this is more part of the fun of the book when we get around to writing it, because getting Shaka to make a declarative sentence in the beginning was nightmarish. I mean, everything was conditional on this and that and the other. And then now, funnily enough, I mean, he's more out there than I am in certain ways. His last book was about the evidence for ESP and things like that. I mean, he's really opened up, Shaka. But as a scientist, he's as cautious as ever he was. So now we really have the evidence to hand. And if we can put the money to do this video, the follow-up to Mystery of the Sphinx, this could be a big deal. And I mean, this is not, you understand this, I think. I'm sure you do, just from a little bit of conversation we had. This is not a quibble among academics. I mean, it really doesn't matter how old is the Sphinx. Why should it matter? What matters is that we're under the control now, scientifically, economically, financially, all sorts of ways, educationally. We're in the grip of what I call the Church of Progress, that we're the most advanced beings that ever existed. And we're watching this thing crumble in front of our eyes. We're watching the cocksucker brothers commandeering the whole goddamn stage. I mean, the worst people in the world are in charge of the country. And I mean, both sides are as bad as each other. They're just different degrees of badness. And unless somebody restores a sense of a true sense of the sacred, I mean, the problem with the religions is that the people who keep talking the most about the religions are the ones who know least about them and don't practice them at all. If they did, we wouldn't be in the pickle that we're in. And of course, the anti-religious group, the so-called rationalists and materialists and Church of Progress faithful, they're by definition malevolent, because they destroy the sense of the meaning of our own individual and collective lives. I mean, if you think if you're really convinced, because this is what we're taught in school, that our lives are worthless, the chances are that you're not going to be living your life in a very productive or creative fashion.
That's right. Not to catch up, but speaking of corrupt people in charge, wasn't Zahi Hawass in charge when you were first starting all this?
Yeah, but that's another funny long story.
Because like, didn't it come out that he was selling things on the black market?
No, he wasn't doing that. But he was, for a variety of reasons, virulently opposed to us. And we had this big fight going on, you know, not physically, but
right,
with him insulting us and me writing, saying nasty things about him. And then, it's a really weird story. I mean, this will be a piece of this book, which will be a pretty extensive book. But I was doing trips with a guy, I mean, I knew better, but organization is not my strength. And he was organizing trips for me. And he was just, it was like dealing with, in a former lifetime, this guy had been a used chariot salesman or something. And I finally broke with him, and he retaliated by, he put more, I said, this is the last trip we're going to do. And he loaded the trip up with more people than I could handle. And that's like, you know, if you have a bucket, and you fill it to the brim. Well, it's full to the brim. It's heavy to carry. But if you keep pouring stuff into it, it's going to go over the brim, and the whole thing is going to be unmanageable. So he did this with a trip. And so I split with him, and I was very nasty to him. And he retaliated because what I do on my trips, well, I should say this, you know, anybody's interested in Egypt. Egypt is a game changer. It teaches you what a real civilization is like. Nowhere else in the world can you experience anything remotely like Egypt. Usually I start off electric. And I say, get people interested. They think they're going to hear all this scholarship, which they are. But I tell them, Egypt is like sex. And they say, well, why is it like sex? And I say, well, you know, you can read all about it, and that's interesting. You look at pictures, that's maybe even more interesting. But until you've actually experienced it, you do not understand anything about it.
I believe that.
And this is true. So anyway, Egypt is a game changer. So back to Zahi. So, so this guy wrote, what I do is technically illegal. I'm not supposed to lecture on the site. But as long as I have an Egyptian guide with me, and that's a good rule, in fact, because otherwise everybody has been to Egypt four times and say, why should we pay an Egyptian guide who's gone through 4 or 5 years of school and passed the test, which is not easy to pass? Why should I spend the money on the guide when I can do all of this myself, which in fact they can't do. It's not that easy to do. For me, really, I don't need somebody there. I teach the guides. But that's good. I like having the guides with me because they run interference when it comes to shopping and all of that kind of stuff. Anyhow, so this guy wrote a letter to the Minister of Tourism saying that I was lecturing on site. And that letter ended up on Zahi Hawass's desk. And so he called up the guy who runs our tour operator, who runs my tour for me. He's a good personal friend and also a good personal friend of Zahi. This is about more than 10 years ago, must be 98, something like that. And he said to Muhammad Nasri, my friend, he said, look, he said, this letter has come on my desk. And, you know, John and I are not friends. And, you know, I know that he makes a living out of doing this. I'm not going to act upon this. So Muhammad called me up, no Skype in those days, and said, hey, look, Zahi is doing this for you. And when you're in Egypt next, which is going to be a couple of weeks, I think you should thank him. I said, you bet I should. So I got there and I went to Zai's office, and Zai's office was always chaos, 5 6 phones at once and people on their knees begging for permission to do this, that, and the other. So he finally gets to me and I tell him, you know, Zahi Muhammad told me what you did and I really want to thank you for doing that. You didn't have to do that. And I'd really like this war to be over. And he said, yes, John, but you started it. I didn't say I didn't start it. He started it. But anyhow, I didn't say that. But since then, we've developed a kind of a weird friendship, because in public, he's as opposed to Shaq and myself as he ever was. But privately, we get on quite well. Huh. And actually, I've always had this sense, and now that he's out of office, technically, he could be coming back in, but he doesn't even want to. He's a big shot now. He can call his own shots. So he can actually do more, both for himself and even, you know, for Egyptology, being not the head of the whole gig. And I'm hoping, he promised he would do this. And then when all this stuff, the protests and things were going on, he said that the people are out gunning for him there. You know, he's made a lot of enemies. And he thought that I wanted to get him to the Giza Plateau to personally show him the evidence and have him quiet so that he's not on 6 phones at once and saying, look, Zahi, this is the case. A, B, C, D, blah, 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 blah.
John, are you going to convert Zahi Hawass?
I've always felt that I might. That he might be open, and if he were not exactly convertible, at least he would say, listen, this is serious, and we have to do more study. I wouldn't expect them to say, well, I guess I was wrong.
If you convert Zahi Hawass, that's almost bigger than finding water erosion on the Sphinx itself.
No. I get the sense from things that he says, from actually a personal level that we have, where we have a dinner and, you know, he comes, I have a group and he comes and makes a lot of noise and talks to people and all the rest. And I know the Egyptians are anyhow very, like the Arabs in general, are very emotional people. They don't sort of repress everything the way we Westerners do. And if they like you, they're not faking it. It's there. And if they don't like you, you know it in 2 seconds. So I get the sense that, and I've had it for a long time, that if Zahi saw the evidence, if he had his, you know, if he had it really shown, okay, Zahi, look, here's this. You know, if you want to oppose the theory, you have to be able to address these different pieces of evidence. And there's a lot of it. It's pointless to talk about them on radio because they're really very visual.
There was something I wanted to ask you, and it goes into all of Egypt, and you've been over there hundreds of times, is why is it? And I think it explains perfectly to your theory and what's holding true is it does seem like the older architecture is actually better made and more amazing in itself, really, than the newer. It's like when you see a civilization.
Yeah, it's like the craftsmanship is better.
It starts off bad and gets better. Not there. It starts off really good. And then looks like it's just been maintained or been patched or been handymanned together the whole time.
By and large. But that gets us into another kind of complexity. That gets us into the what the Indians, the Hindus, in the Vedas called, the Kali Yuga, the cycles of, which is also Platonic, Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, or Dark Age, and then the cycle starts going up again. Now, this is another complicated issue, but that's, I think, what we're looking at. That, and then in between all of this comes whatever the catastrophe was back around 12,000 BC, and then another one around 9,600 BC. Shaka's convinced that one of them, what is it, the Younger Dryas, that's the one 12,000 BC, is a cometary event of some sort, and the later one is a coronal blast from...
Yeah, mass coronal ejection.
Mass coronal ejection. And that's what brings on the flood and the melting of the ice age and all of that stuff. I may have it not quite right, but Shaka is very knowledgeable about that. If you get him on in a couple of weeks, you can get into that with him.
And we've got his books. Yeah,
his newest book is Forgotten Civilization or something, and I think that's exactly what it's about.
He knows the stuff, and we have different... I mean, I'm much more, let's say, familiar with, I'm not a scientist, so, but I'm much more familiar with the esoteric aspects of it and the philosophy and the religion and the symbolism and, to a certain extent, the geometry and all that sort of stuff. So it's a good combination, actually, because we have complementary strengths rather than the same strengths. If it's the same strength, why do you need a collaborator?
That's right.
have different ones, that's good.
What we were discussing earlier with the precession of the equinox, could you tell the listeners about the way the layout of the pyramids and the way the layout of the Sphinx facing Leo, it almost lines up astronomically to a certain actual number of years the past also?
Well, yeah. Actually, the precession of the equinoxes, for example, if you look now at the the zodiac, and the reasons why this happens are in dispute. But if you look at the spring equinox now, before the sun rises, and watch where the sun comes up, you'll find that it comes up in the very last degrees of and this is arguable because it's not as though there's a line in the sky, but the last degrees of Pisces, meaning that it's precession, so it goes around backwards, so that the next age will be the age of Aquarius. And this is, hair and all of those things, the age of Aquarius. So when you look at the Sphinx faces due east, and it's a lion now with a man's head. It might not have had a man's head to begin with. It might have been a lion. It's been recarved. All of these things are, this is tough to do on radio because, it's hard to get the visual images for it. And all of these things are very complex. So anyway, the last time, if the Sphinx, it kind of screams out as an astronomical, astrological marker of Leo, because it's a lion. And if the Sphinx is facing due east, the last time that the spring equinox occurred in the age of Leo was 10,000 years ago. Sorry, around 10,000 BC. And the time before that, because it's a 26,000 year cycle, is 36,000 BC. Now, what's interesting about that is that that 36,000 BC cycle corresponds to what the Egyptians are talking about themselves in the Palermo Stone and the Turin Papyrus. Schock was initially very cautious about this earlier dating, even though the Egyptian texts themselves are talking about, when you compute all those regnal years for all of those divine kings and semi-divine kings, which of course the Quacademics simply ignore, don't regard as real or just as primitive imagination, you compute those out and you get something like that's 36,000 years. They disagree with each other a little bit, 34,000 years, 36,000 years, but roughly speaking, that's the kind of date that they're putting on this. And this is not so fantastic. I mean, when you're dealing with the Quacademics, there are other pieces of evidence that suggest, I mean, apart, we got Göbekli Tepe, and now there's Gunung Padang, the Schock again, in this cautious way. He spent a week there, and he said, yeah, this really looks like it's very, very old, but lots more work has to be done there. With Göbekli Tepe, lots more work has to be done, but there it's really pretty solid. Klaus Schmidt, the German archaeologist who's the head of the excavation, he's not a flake. He's an absolutely orthodox Egyptologist, or rather archaeologist with, a rare quality. He doesn't think he knows everything. That's rare in any of these sciences.
Yeah.
He's the one who put the dating on it, and this has got to be solid because even his own colleagues are not challenging him on it. So that's important. You know, if we're saying it, or even Schock, I mean, with all his credentials, well, we're already committed to a different point of view. They could attack us, but they're not attacking Schmidt. This is serious. And we've got all of this evidence now. And even before that, if people put the evidence together or recognized its implications, the case would already be a strong one. For example, the Paleolithic caves. You know about those, right? Of course, Lascaux and Altamira.
Yes.
Right? And do you know about the most spectacular one found relatively recently called Chauvet?
Yes, I watched a documentary on that one.
But you watched that documentary, the Herzog thing. Unfortunately, I mean, Herzog's a wonderful director, and that was a lousy film where he just let the Quacademics blather on without any sense of how important this really was. But they date that, and it's hard to imagine that the dating is incorrect, to 31,000 BC. And as art, it's of a much higher level than even Lascaux and the Hall of Bulls in Altamira, which are dated around 17,000 and 19,000 BC. So you've got these guys putting paint on rough walls, presumably with their fingers. And how could they light the damn things, you know, and painting animals that look like they've been painted by Picasso. So, you know, maybe they're living in grass in reed huts and they're wearing bear skins. But, but you know, you can't take a whole bunch of PhD quantum physicists and stick them in a cave and tell them to paint bulls and lions and things like that with their bare hands and get anything out of them. So even things like that presupposes an extremely sophisticated artistic sensibility. And of course, you know, these jackasses think, you know, the artists and creative people are, you know, we're regarded as kind of nutcases and things like that. And the only thing that really means anything is rational science and proving this, that, and the other. And this is from people who can't, with their own bare hands, put a dry stone wall together, much less write a sonnet, compose a symphony. So the whole thing is completely, completely topsy-turvy and upside down. And as I said, this concept, and it's not just me. It's lots of people now. I mean, it started off by Schroller in terms of Egyptology, and you know, certain other people throughout. It's not as though we invented this from scratch. We're carrying on, but with better evidence, seems that have been going on well from time immemorial, but for sure since Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy in the latter half of the 19th century. You know, we're not inventing this from scratch, but we're putting scientific and scholarly teeth into it that it didn't have before. So the only thing that's going to get us, as far as I'm concerned, the only thing that's going to get us out of the morass that we're dug into by our own stupidity and greed and all of these, you know, all of the terrible stuff that's going on is the changing of ideas. I mean, it's Victor Hugo, a famous line, you probably know it. There's one thing stronger than all the armies in the world, and that's an idea whose time has come. Well, this was good, but what he neglected to say or observe was that the second strongest thing in the world is an idea whose time has not yet gone. So we think we've got the idea whose time has come, but it's not going to come automatically. It's only going to come if we make the right moves and enough of us get behind it to make it happen. And meanwhile, the second strongest idea in the world is, you know, the whole all of quackademia, modern education, which I describe somewhere where one of my books as modern education is to the mind what AIDS is to the immune system. The more the more contact you have with it, the more likely it is to be lethal. And it's like that. I mean, mm-hmm. Go talk to a PhD at any party and see what kind of who you're talking to. There are exceptions, of course. Shock is one of them. But like HIV, you know, you can carry HIV in your body your whole life and be perfectly healthy. But one thing goes wrong and you're cooked. Anyhow, so the crux of it is, as I said, the importance of this is, I repeat myself, it's not a quibble among academics. It's a question of enough people recognizing that our lives have a meaning and that we're on this earth for a specific purpose. I mean, Egypt is a one-issue civilization, and that civilization was devoted to, at least at its higher levels, but even in the lower levels, the quarrymen and the people who were doing the building and all of it, it's trickle-down spirituality, which is valid. And it's devoted, it's consecrated to the idea that there is such a thing as the immortality of the soul. And all of Egypt, everything that was religious, in one sense or another, and religion is what, in its true sense, not idiots telling women what to do with their body or, you know, whether gays should marry or not, as if it was any of their goddamn business. And actually, they should, you know, I mean, they don't think straight, these gay bashes and stuff, because when you really look at it, you look at most of these guys who are the most adamant about it, and you can see that these are guys who have a lot of trouble getting laid. And and if they really, really went out and promoted homosexuality, if there were enough guys who are gay, there's a joke, you know, the famous joke. You know, why is it that it's so difficult for a woman to find a, you know, a good looking, intelligent, sensitive, you know, financially sound male? And the answer is, well, they've already got boyfriends. And and so if the gay bashers would sort of promote it, I mean, if there are enough guys really turn gay, they'd find some woman who'd even sleep with them, whereas otherwise it's difficult. So it's very counterproductive. It's very counterproductive on their part. Yeah, I lost my thread. What were we on about here?
Well, I was going to ask you, John. Do you feel like it's that more people with the freedom of information due to the internet, due to these podcasts, YouTube, due to all these blogs? Do you feel like more people are beginning to take notice faster on the information that you're providing? As far as all the, it seems like it's snowballing faster the last few years.
listen, when I got into this, when I first booked The Case for Astrology, I mean, it was a book, and, you know, it was not too unsuccessful, but, you know, it doesn't have an impact. But The Mystery of the Sphinx, I mean, that was sort of a miracle that we actually got that thing onto NBC, and it went viral around.
And you got Charlton Heston, which you can't argue with Moses when he's standing up there on the Sphinx telling you that shit.
That's right. Well,
can't argue with that.
Well, we did get Charlton Heston. Actually, that was a funny story. Originally, what we wanted was, let's see, when was this? 93. And so we wanted, first choice was Harrison Ford, because you needed an image.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
So that was the Indiana Jones image, would have been perfect. But he liked the idea, but he was too busy and we couldn't get him and he was too expensive. So the next choices were Charlton Heston, Moses' image, and Raymond Burr, Perry Mason, solver of puzzles image. And Heston, I didn't like much like his politics. And, you know, he's sort of a wooden actor and Moses' image and Ben-Hur and all this stuff. So I was sort of for Raymond Burr. But we would ask around, and we could afford both of them. It was the same $75,000 for the day. You know, that was low. Harrison Ford would have been about four times that. Anyway, so I was sort of for Raymond Burr, but we were asking, all of us were involved in the thing. And we talked to our friends, and the women would say, this was the choice, Raymond Burr and Charlton Heston. The women would all say, wow, Charlton Heston. And we said, okay, we don't care. Us guys don't care really if it's Charlton Heston or Raymond Burr. But if the women who are half the audience think that Charlton Heston is cool, good, we'll go with Charlton. And then he turned in this wonderful performance. I mean, he really liked the script. Strangely enough, the really ultra white right-wing guys have less trouble with our stuff. Now, he wasn't ultra right wing, but the sort of the right wingers have much less trouble with the whole concept of an advanced ancient civilization than the left wingers, who, whatever they may say, are priests of the Church of Progress. They really do believe, well, they believe in selection pressure and Darwinian evolution, which is, evolution is a fact. Selection pressure and Darwinian evolution is a fraud, but that's another matter to go into at some future date. Chuck and I are going to do another, we hope, the definitive book on anti-Darwin book.
And the way it's going, we're going to have you on another half a dozen times, John.
Well, okay. Let's see if we get, it's fun. But I've got to tell you, you know, it's fun for me too, as long as I've got my vodka and here we are, Gavin.
That's right.
But something has to come out of it. Because, you know, in other words, people going on my trips or, you know, there needs to be some feedback. So let's see what happens.
And I also like that you talk about not just the Sphinx, but there's a lot of other structures there in Egypt where it almost looks like they were built upon an even older structure that's beneath
tons
that.
Of them.
Yeah, so that almost lends, you know, credence to that there's an older civilization, much older than the mainstream archaeologists agree.
This is if on this next trip, which is just a few days from now, if I get Zahi to come around with me, and he's promised to do so, and in fact, a while back, but then there was all of this trouble going on, and as I said, I didn't finish that thought earlier, because there are a lot of people gunning for Zahi around the plateau because he threw people out of their houses because he wanted to dig under them to look for artifacts and things like that. Well, that didn't make him any friends.
Right.
So when the infrastructure broke down, he said, yeah, he'd go with me. And then he decided, no, this is, you know, too many people gunning for him, and he didn't trust security. But now the security should be okay again. And we'll see if he comes along with me, because that's exactly what I want to show him, that there are all of these different pieces of evidence. Each one of them, in and of itself, commanding, I mean, compelling. If just one of them is correct, like the water weathering to the Sphinx, there's no arguing with all the rest, but there are lots of them. There are dozens of things to show him that support the theory and nothing that challenges it. So we'll see. Yeah, with you.
Yeah.
Call me back somewhere. I get back. When do I get back? 15th of February, you know, sometime the end of February. call me back and I'll give you a status report.
Okay.
Where we stand with that.
That sounds good.
And the meanwhile, where are we now? Well, we're at an hour mark. Let's because, you know, this, as you see, the way I've been babbling on here, in Egypt, this is 8 hours a day of this, and I'm still racing for time because it's such a big subject. But, I mean, I think for your purposes, you've got a pretty good idea, even though it's sort of jumbled and garbled. People should have a pretty good idea of what's involved. And, you know, let's see what kind of feedback you get. And I'm game for more. Well, that, I enjoy doing this. It's fun. It's fun getting it out to people. But again, I don't like to sound crass about it, but what's in it for me? You know, if nobody gets back to you, and it's fun and games for you guys, but yeah, it would be some people sign on for trips or ask intelligent questions or buy some books or something like that.
Right. Well, how often do you do these trips?
I have been doing them about four times a year, and they've been cut way back recently because of the revolution and all this stuff. I have this one coming up, which is full, next week. And then I'm hoping, and I don't even have it up on my website yet because I'm hopelessly inefficient about that stuff, but there may be one March 12th to March 25th. And whether or not that works, I don't know. But if anybody listening wants to jump onto that one, good, it's open.
And then, yeah, how do people, if they're interested in going on a tour with you instructing it, I mean, where do people go to sign up for something like that?
To my website.
And what is that?
JAWest.com.
Okay.
And you click on Magical Egypt Tours. And as I said, the March trip, the full details aren't there, but the last trip, the details are there, and it's close enough to that so you can judge. Or they email me. Well, that information is on the website, but it's my initials, JAW, Sphinx, SPHINX, at AOL.com. So get in touch. And then there'll certainly be a trip as long as Egypt doesn't disintegrate, and I don't think it will, now that the military's in charge. There'll be a trip end of October, early November, and then another one late November or December. So plenty of opportunity. And as I mentioned earlier, the sooner the better, because as soon as, I mean, Egypt, you just can't imagine what it's like empty. It's
a perfect time to do it. If I had the money, I would do it. And if I was there, I would most certainly want you to guide me.
You're in Texas. I thought everybody was rich in Texas.
Well, not all of us.
Anyway, the sooner you get onto it, because, having done as many trips as I've done, I've learned where people are going to be at what sort of time. So we're very good at avoiding the worst of the crowds, no matter what. But avoiding not having crowds there at all is just, it's heaven. It's like, nobody's experienced Egypt like that since the 1850s. It's really, you just can imagine what it's like. I mean, it's horrible for the poor Egyptians because so many of them depend upon the tourist trade for their living.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Well, it's heart-wrenching, but, I mean, it's not our fault that the other, that people aren't going there. So for us, it's take advantage of this wonderful situation.
Well, that's incredible. And I wished I had the money to go and join you, and maybe one day soon I will. I just want to thank you again for coming on. Your work is fascinating. It was eye-opening to me. You're one of the first people that ever made me start to question that what I was taught in school about ancient cultures and Egypt especially is not necessarily true. And
good.
If it wasn't for you and Dr. Shock and stuff like that, I mean,
that's what really got the ball rolling. Yeah, that's what really got me to thinking and really doing a lot more looking into a little bit of everything.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And once you're bitten, you can't stop.
It's like Pandora's box. Once you've cracked it open, it's like now there's no going back.
That's right. That's right. course, you do lose a lot of friends that way.
But you make some really good ones along the way, too, though.
Well, you do. You do make some good ones, but you also are taught, when you start talking about these things, how conditioned so many people are, how many people don't want to hear. They're just happy with what they've been taught, and they don't want to hear. It's very strange. But a lot of them are not that way. Listen, that Mystery of the Sphinx, the video, I reckon it went around the world. It was probably viewed by at least a few hundred million people over in the various countries. And people remember it. Just as you, just, mm-hmm. This is not uncommon. People see it at a certain impressionable age, anything usually from 12 to 20. And it sticks with them. It suddenly, yeah, we're very proud of that.
And I can go back and watch it again and again. I enjoy watching it.
Yeah,
I still enjoy it now. Yeah, I still enjoy it now.
Yeah, well, it's you know, I mean, it was not only really popular, it was nominated for an Emmy for Best Documentary of the Year, and I won an Emmy for research. They actually give such an Emmy.
Nice.
Documentaries. So it looks very good on the shelf. Actually, it looks good on the track record. And the shelf, not, I mean, it's a horrible looking, I don't know who the hell designed the thing. It looks like it was designed by Hitler. So the Oscar, too. It's horrible looking stuff. But it does look good on the track record. So anyway, Kyle and Cam, I will sign off here. And you let me know what kind of feedback you get.
Okay, John, we will. Thank you so much for coming on with us. We love talking with you. Take care of yourself. Bye.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives Classic Rewind. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with John Anthony West. He was an incredible man, an incredible researcher, and the world just isn't going to be the same without him. I'm so thankful that we got the chance to speak with him. If you want to learn more, be sure to pick up some of his books. You can find them on Amazon. They are The Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, and The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, A Guide to Sacred Places. You can search them up yourselves, or you can go to the show notes where I will put direct links in there for you. Don't forget, before we get out of here, if you have a story you want to share with Cam and I, just email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Please subscribe, rate, and write us a review on whatever podcatcher you're using. Also, please share the show with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth is still the very best way to grow a podcast, believe it or not. Please go over to YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Even if you have no intentions of ever listening or watching us over there, we're trying to grow our channel, and every little bit helps out way more than you know. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. Till next time, be safe and pay someone a compliment this week. You know, pay it forward, people. Peace.